Hello, and welcome to this episode of Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. This is a show all about music, popular music, classical music, music performance, education, composition, all things related to music. I talk about my own experiences in music, I'm an opera singer, and also a music theorist. I'm currently getting my PhD in music theory from the University of Michigan. And I have guests on the show to talk about what they do in music as well. Today on the show, it's a bonus episode. I have a conversation with Rafael Fusco, who is a composer, a pianist, and a conductor. He's also one of the faculty members of Opera Luca, which is a young artist program for singers and composers that takes place every summer in Lucca, Italy. If you've listened to the show, then you know that I got to attend Opera Luca in the summer of 2023. So we talk all about Rafael's work with Opera Luca, we discuss the piece that he composed specifically for the Opera Luca program. We get to listen to a bit of the piece, and stay tuned, you do get to hear a little bit of yours truly. And we talk about Rafael's current work in Austria. Check the show notes for the links to all of his work. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the podcast. By now, you have heard a whole season of the podcast this fall, and this we're bringing to you at the end of that season. So he's a composer, he's a conductor, he does a bunch of different things in music research as well, so we're going to get all into it today. We have Rafael Fusco on the podcast. How are you?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So as I mentioned, we met this summer in Italy when I went to sing with Opera Luca, which is a young artist program, and I'm really, really glad that I got that opportunity. We just got all of our videos and pictures and recordings back, so I was watching some of the performances, and I think they turned out pretty well. So would you be willing to just say a little bit about your work with Opera Luca and what that experience has been like in general?
Sure. Yeah, it's been a pleasure of mine to be a part of Opera Luca since the start of it. Dr. James Massol, who is the executive director of the festival, we go back to our college days, and he started this festival with the idea of bringing students from all over the world, opera singers from all over the world, to Italy, the birthplace of opera, to do intensive work on the Italian language. Learning to speak it, learning the grammar, learning the phonetics, the lyric diction, learning the repertoire, performance practice, bel canto, baroque, everything coming together in this place where, I mean, the food is just the best in the world. Yes. So it's really the perfect place to hone in on your opera skills and the language and really see where these two worlds of language and music come together to make something expressive. So like I said, I've been there since the start of it. As a vocal coach, then I started conducting some scenes in there. And recently, 2 years ago, we started a composition program to bring in composers to give them a chance to work with English and the Italian language, to write songs, collaborate with the young artists of the program, develop new works, and have the premiere. So I get to wear three hats in this festival as a composer, a conductor, and a vocal coach, which are the three pillars to my career as a musician. And so I'm just happy to be in such a beautiful place where I can bring these three aspects, these three facets of my musicianship together and be at the service of these very talented young artists.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. So thank you for sharing that. And again, it was such a lovely experience for me as a student of the program. I particularly loved all of the Italian lessons with the Lucca Italian School. Fantastic teachers there. I feel like my Italian has come such a long way. So, sì, dobbiamo practicare, sì?
dobbiamo fare un po' di pratica, certo, molto volentieri.
Oh no! Molto I'm volentieri. Exposed.
I think that'd be another. I think that'd be another. I think that'd be another podcast. Yeah, we can do that in Italian for,
yes,
for your Italian.
Are there any Italian listeners listening? Should I do a whole podcast in Italian? That would be a good exercise.
Si,
you know,
si.
Maybe Ciao. Maybe just a 15-minute little, you guys can hear me stumble through some Italian.
Yeah, little five-minute thing. Or you talk about your favorite thing that you learned about the diction. Because that's, I mean, I think the coolest thing about this mm-hmm. program is once you start to know the language, once you start to hear it on the streets, and then you start to see the melodies that the composers crafted, whether it was like an Austrian like Mozart or an Italian like Verdi, when they're writing in Italian, the music, there's this music in the language already. Mm-hmm. And the better you know the language, then the more access you have to the music that's going on there and the way these two worlds come together. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely, yes.
This is a really special place.
Listeners, send me an email if you're trying to practice some Italian. You know, we can we can link up. Great. So let's get started with talking a bit about you and your own personal background in music. So if you could inform me and the listeners of where you're from and where your family is from, and the early music experiences you were having as a child. So the music that was happening in the place where you're from and in your family, if you're from a musical family, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm.
Cool. I'm from New Jersey. I was born on the Jersey Shore in Neptune, New Jersey, right outside of Asbury Park, which means the early musical experiences. There was a lot of Bruce Springsteen.
Okay.
There was a lot of greetings from Asbury Park. There was a lot of, I'm an Italian American family, so I'm second generation American. My grandparents were both born in Italy on my father's side. And so there was some Italian music. There was a lot of Frank Sinatra. Mm. Not so much classical music. Mm. And so I don't come from a musical family. My father is a big fan of rock and roll, likes his music, but it's not what I would say. They're not musicians. They don't, nobody of my family, except for my brother and I, play. So sometimes I think that my finding classical music was almost like a way of rebelling against my parents or something. You see, classical music was a thing that was different from what everybody else was doing. No, that's more of a joke. But I started playing the piano when I was around 7. And I wanted to play the cello. I saw classical music every once in a while on TV or with like Snoopy and Charlie Brown. Like there was little hints and traces of it around, but it wasn't really brought directly into my home. I went to Catholic school, so there was there was mass, and so like once a week you get everybody singing these songs together, and that was a really cool experience for me because I heard like, wait, what's going on here? There's something magical, something ritualistic mm-hmm. about this, where like all these different people are coming together and singing a melody, mm-hmm. and the melodies were pretty simple, and so I would kind of stick around after school and plunk out on the piano keyboard the tunes, and I was really into that. Then at a certain point, the music teachers and the people in the church said to my parents, hey, maybe there's something going on with this kid. I got a little keyboard that plugged into my Super Nintendo. That was my first piano teacher. It's called the Miracle Piano Teaching System. So anybody who used to use Super Nintendo back in the day, shout out to you guys. And it was cool because you have this keyboard and it taught you how to play songs, like Michael Row the Boat Ashore, going up to you culminate in Celebration. Celebrate good time. And there was the band on the screen. If you play a wrong note, like the screen gets all red. It's like, no, it's kind of like Mario Dies. You play the wrong note and you're like, wah, wah, wah. And that was it.
Oh my goodness.
But it was cool like to be like on my own, just discovering music with the computer, with this video game, because automatically it was like it was playing. It wasn't like, like the teacher traditionally thing, like with the ruler slapping your hand. It was a video game experience. And then there was this other thing at the video games were a really big part of my my musical experience growing up too.
Yeah.
So besides the Miracle Keyboard, which was just so much fun, there was also this game called Mario Paint. And Mario Paint was my first thing, like with a mouse and a special trackpad that plugged into the Super Nintendo. There's this one like little part of the game where there was a staff, and you would have like the fire flowers or the stars or the mushrooms, like all Mario's little like symbols that you could put on the staff, and they'd make all little like video game sounds. And so I had no idea that I was composing, but around like 7 years old, I'm just like dragging these things, I'm like, oh, that sounds good, oh, that doesn't sound good, and like writing these songs with Mario Paint.
What?
And I was like, wow, this is a lot of fun. Meanwhile, my parents are like, what the hell is he doing with his video games all day? Well, I'm like, I'm building a career for myself out there. And then so I got a little bit older, the video games, then I had like Final Fantasy. Final Fantasy III had like the best video game soundtracks of all time that I put
Great
on par
soundtracks.
with with some of the greatest operas. I mean, even still going back and you hear those songs, they're so emotionally engaging. And so there was that whole video game thing. Eventually I started taking piano lessons with Tommy Zvonček, who played rock keyboards with groups like the Blue Oyster Cult. That was cool because I was playing off of jazz lead sheets. I was improvising. I was taking tunes off of the radio, transcribing them, stuff at like 10 years old. So before I was playing like classical music, I'm getting like real musicianship skills. Then I started getting into the classical thing, started writing my own music on the page, giving it to girls, saying, hey, I wrote this for you. I was a romantic at heart. I went to performing arts high school in Red Bank, New Jersey, Red Bank Regional High School, which was cool because then in the mornings I do normal classes. The afternoon I would do music theory, piano, choir, musicals and all that type of stuff. So that was cool. Played some upright bass. Went to Manhattan School of Music as a kid. Studied composition and conducting. 16, I graduated from high school and I moved by myself to Italy. Left my family in America. 16-year-old got a job teaching English to the head of Lavazza, the coffee company, and studied at the conservatory in Torino, the Verdi Conservatory. So I'm 16 years old. Leave, I knew some Italian. I was, decent at it. I could understand, but I left, had this experience that was life-changing. And since then, Italy has been a huge part of my life since, getting in contact with the family, having to, grow up on my own, do my laundry, pay my rent, and do all that stuff in Italy when the lira was switching to the euro. And so it was an exciting experience.
Listeners, there's so much here. I can't, first of all, I'm like hung up on like the head of Lavazza. Are you joking? Did you
I mean,
get to
I, there
like
was
drink all
this.
this coffee for free?
Yeah, his English was terrible, which I guess is partially my fault. But his coffee was excellent, and it was cool because right across the street from my apartment, there was this little language school. One day, I was like, you know what, I need some money, and it wasn't like cell phones and internet. When I was living in Italy, like it was a phone booth and a calling card away from home, so it wasn't just like oh wire transfers and stuff. So like, all right, we got to get me a job. I walked into this language school across the street. This younger British couple was running. I mean, I was 16, so I mean they were older than that. But and I was like, hey, do you guys need and you need an English teacher? And they were like, yeah, because our English teacher just like dropped out, and we have the first lesson with the head of Lavazza today. Will you go to it? I mean, they didn't check my credential. They heard I could speak, but they were just like, we need a body in the room. You go, and I loved it, and it was great, teaching them, and I mean, learning the Italian and teaching the English and really getting in the other person's brain and culture. That was essential for me to really assimilate, because even if you grow up Italian American, once you're on the other side of the ocean, is a very different type of Italy. The food, the language, the culture, the hand gestures, like things are very different. So to have that experience in my formative years was really, I mean, that was a huge blessing. It was the hardest time of my life. Because you can imagine, I have to learn like real life skills without really anybody there at home to either go crying to or tell. I had family over there, distant family that I became very close to, but just that experience studying music in Italy was huge for me. Studying opera, studying composition, getting the old school education in contrapunto and in counterpoint, harmony, score reading. Stuff that is more and more absent from modern composition curricula. But that's probably a story for another podcast. Cool. So I mean, all right, I'm a teenager, right? At that point, I'll try to fast forward through the rest of it because I realize that it's a long time just getting that far. But it was a pretty busy adolescence. Came back to New York. I studied at the Mannes College of Music. I decided at that point I was doing piano, I was doing composition, but I really loved making stuff up. I loved the composing, so I studied that. I did my By 21, I had my master's, and I was out and about teaching, gigging in the city, and coaching singers because I had the language background and was a good sight reader, doing all this stuff. And then fast forward, yeah, tons of commissions, gigs, living the New York life. I met my wife, who's German, from Bavaria and fell in love, saw this is the one. And then in 2017, I moved to Munich, Germany. And then, yeah, I've been in Austria since 2019 as a senior artist in the University for Performing Arts here in Graz. So it took longer to get through the first 16 years of my life rather than the last like 20 years, but.
Wow.
A lot
exciting.
Going on.
And it's so, you know, it's so refreshing for me always to be in community with people that have such multifaceted careers and that do so many different things. I remember being when I was finishing my master's at Roosevelt University in Chicago in voice, and I felt so stifled there by like by this narrative of like, okay, you are getting trained to be a singer, and so we're going to do it in this, you know, very particular way in which we train singers. There's, you know, a huge language component, there's not a huge reading and writing component, there's but I could tell that during my time there I had realized that I was interested in interacting with music in like so many different ways, and that I was having these like music theoretical questions about music that I didn't really recognize as like music theory at the time, but right, like that I had questions about interpretation and about language and about harmony and about that I wasn't getting in a voice program because they're just here to be like, you know, this is how you move your lips or whatever. Yeah. So I was like, okay. Yeah. And so it's always really encouraging to me to get to witness firsthand careers that have so many different facets to them, because that's the kind of career that I'm trying to build for myself. I love singing and I want to continue singing and I love opera and I love art song. But I love research as well and I love teaching. I've been so pleasantly surprised by my time at Michigan in terms of teaching. Right now I teach aural skills, undergrad aural skills, and I'm at the sophomore level right now. And it's been so fun. So it's just really cool to hear about how you develop so many different skills and how you actually get to utilize them in such fascinating ways. So thank you for sharing.
Sure, yeah. You know, I think there's something to be said about the non-traditional paths to becoming a musician. You know, there's also something to be said about this is the about the traditional path of you start and work progressively on an instrument. I mean, you can, yeah, it leads to mastering what you're doing, but it does lead on another, I guess, on the other hand, to a little bit of a myopic view or if not closed-minded even, just kind of stuck in one field. But rather, you know, especially for a composer, to be able to see music from a performer's point of view, to understand music from a singer's point of view, a pianist, the conductor, the theory, see the language elements, you know, by having all these different fields, you get to actually see across domains. And usually where things get very segmented, especially in academia, the real magic is what happens once we start connecting these dots from discipline to discipline. And then we're like, ah, the same thing that's happening in language is happening in music. Right. The same thing the singer is doing to give emphasis to what does the pianist is giving emphasis. How does that affect the way that I compose when I want to give the performer something to emphasize? And so all of these different fields, they kind of inform each other and build on each other in an exciting way.
Yeah, no, that is really fascinating that like what you're saying in terms of composition being inherently like interdisciplinary, and you have to kind of dip into all these different elements of music, of performance, and of the music theoretical and historical, and of language and of right. I've talked about on this podcast many a time. I took one composition class during my undergrad, very close to failing. I was not good, but I really appreciated getting the opportunity to even try, right? To like sit down and to think through what this would be like for somebody to perform this. Can somebody perform something like this? And how would they go about doing that? And how, you know, so to...
And that's so cool because you put yourself in the shoes of somebody putting themselves in the shoes of another person. You're like, because you got to think like, if you have a violinist, right? It doesn't... I mean, okay, yeah, the more we know, okay, is great. But a violinist, it's not really his problem how a clarinetist makes a certain multiphonic, or it's not really the trumpet, it's not the trumpeter's problem. How does that double bass play with the French or the German bow, whatever, you know? And so the instrument, like they have their skills, their techniques. And of course, playing in chamber music, it helps to know a lot. But for the composer, I mean, it's existential. It's the difference between getting the job done or not. Mm-hmm. Knowing as much as you can about all these different instruments, mm-hmm. and what they can do and how they work together, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, this also brings up something that I have also taken. I don't know that I've mentioned this on the show, but I did have to take a conducting class also during my
undergrad.
What? I was like, what? It was so hard.
And she says as she waves her hand in the air with the perfect
no,
beat.
But like, no. It was so difficult. And the final project, I remember you had to like conduct the class, so everybody in the class had to learn like a Haydn symphony or whatever, you know, like 16 bars of a Haydn symphony, and then you had to conduct the class, and it was so hard. Just the transposition, like, what's going on? What? And I'm a theorist and I still have to transpose, but I'm like, what? So it was just, you know, again, it's interesting how those types of music collaborators, coaches, conductors, composers are all involved in working with music in this interdisciplinary way, versus when you're just, and not just, but you know, when you're solely an instrumentalist or solely a vocalist, and your skills are so specialized, you, like you said earlier, perhaps there are some perspectives that you miss out on, or that you don't regularly get the opportunity to engage with, and you have to kind of seek out those opportunities a bit more, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well said.
Yeah. So, but I'm a theorist now and a singer, and I love it. And I think because
Which is an odd combination, actually.
You know?
I have to say, I remember when we looked at your application, I was like, wait, no, which one is she? And then I was like, wait, she's both? They do that? They allow... All right, cool. And then I heard you sing, and I was like, yes, she's that. I was like, now, you know, submit some of your writing on theory so that we can accept you into the composition program, too. But, you know, since your composing endeavors weren't so successful yet, there's always next summer. There's next summer. We'll take you in the program.
I don't even know what that would... But, yeah, I mean, you're right that normally when we think of music theorists, it's generally like... pianists or composers, or there are so many, you know, theory and comp degrees and combining music theory and composition. So yeah, it tends to kind of be associated with other backgrounds. But yeah, I think that's the thing, is I always was so interested in the musical details. And I remember being in this master's program and I was like, are y'all seeing this? This is so cool.
Yeah.
Look at the piano here. And the other singers were like, piano? What? Look at the accompaniment. What are you talking about?
Me.
No, literally. And I was just like, oh, are we not? Again, I had started to, like you're saying, connect those dots of the music historical and context and the, you know, and so I could tell that being quote unquote just being solely a singer was not going to be fulfilling for me. I think in a way that I had been told. I've been really happy to diversify my skills and my connections and the ways that I'm engaging with music. So yes, I also want to talk to you about, again, kind of circling back to our summer in Opera Luca, my absolute favorite thing that I got to sing was Contessa Canora. Wait, Canora Contessa? Am I getting it wrong?
That's kind of funny. I mean, that's been a long ongoing story. It's La Contessa Canora.
Yes.
But the problem is so this was the second year. This is a piece that Opera Luca co-commissioned with another festival I teach in Classic Lyric Arts in Nova Feltre, Italy. It was a co-commission of these two festivals. And it was not this past summer, but the summer before that we did the world premiere of it. And I had just simply written the title wrong on the page of my first sketches. I wrote it as La Canora Contessa, which still, I mean, with the adjective before or after, it can work either way.
Right.
It's more eloquent, actually, the original La Contessa Canora from Rinuccini. But the problem is when you spend 8 weeks in two festivals, constant, not to mention the months it took to compose the work, referring to it as one thing, and all of a sudden your baby changes the same, or you realize, oh, I spelt my baby's name wrong. Oh, I got to check. But, you know, my kid is now 16 years old, and you're like, oh, what am I going to do? Am I changing now? So I understand your confusion. And even to this point now, I have probably 80 singers in the world who have participated in this piece, and half of them call it one way, a quarter of them call it the other, and then the other is just like, I don't know. So
that one Fusco piece, I don't know. So
but that's a classic. I have a tendency of just like sometimes I get so excited about like and one little typo like has a way of like just digging into the to the cornerstone of the piece and becoming deeply ingrained into it. And you have to say, you know what, it's kind of like a snaggletooth thing. Is it perfect? No, but it's got personality and it's part of the product.
No, but that's gonna be one of those like fun Easter eggs that when people are writing about it 100 years from now, they're gonna be like, you know, there's so much discrepancy in the name. You know, that's your.
And then you're gonna get the purists who are gonna be like, no, we have to go to the original autograph, yes. Whether it's right or wrong. It's like, no, but that's why I made the second draft, because I had to make it better. You're gonna go back and undo all the work. I see that very often, especially around your
Wikipedia page where they, you know, under controversy, like this is the controversy.
What's keeping the jury out is still keeping them all involved. So if so long as they're talking, let's give them something to talk about.
Yes. So let's talk about that now. I'll, for the listeners, include a couple snippets of the singing and of the final performance, which was really, really fun. So let's talk about how the piece even came to be and kind of your compositional process behind it.
So James came to me in, I think it was probably January of 21. No, it was a 12 of 2 year of 2 summers ago. Mm-hmm. He said, I want you to write a piece that's going to get all of the singers involved. And in these young artist programs, there's very often a lot more sopranos and mezzos than there are tenors and basses, just a lot more women involved. He says, you know, Suor Angelica is always our thing, but after a while, we want to, you know, put a piece that can go with it, that's still going to keep all of the female singers involved, that's going to put them all to work. And so I was thinking, what can I do? It's got to be in Italian. Mm-hmm. And so I scoured through. And then for me, I was like, it's got to be in the public domain. I don't want to deal with the rights. I don't want to deal with all this stuff, because there wasn't time to start negotiating with publishing houses. So I went way back to Rinuccini, who was the librettist of the first opera, Jacopo Peri's La Daphne. Mm-hmm. And he was a big shot librettist like back during the Medici's time in the Renaissance. And he wrote these intermezzi, which were like little plays that were meant to, or little like mini operas that were meant to be put on during the intermission of bigger works. Or bigger ceremonies, let's say, because at that point we didn't really have like the operas yet. It was still a budding genre and art form. And so I found this story about the muses from Ovid's Metamorphoses, about the muses versus the Pieridi sisters. And it's this really cool story about arrogance versus virtue, beauty of singing. And I was like, wow, these are some themes that I think are important, that are useful in a summer festival. Again, especially since it's in Italian, in beautiful Italian. And so pretty much it's the exact libretto. It's the same words written in the 16th century that tells a story of the arrogant Pieridi sisters who challenged the muses to a singing competition. I was like, a singing competition in a young artist program? Perfect.
Yes.
Who'd have thunk? And so they challenge them to the duel. The muses are like, all right, you know, we're better than you, but if we say that we're not going to compete with you, it's going to make us look bad. So the Pierides sing their song, saying they're the best singers in the world. And then the muses sing their song that says, hey, it's all about beauty proceeding from the heavens and coming to earth and being one with the wonder and the beauty of the universe. That message yields, that makes them the winners. And then the muses turn, as a punishment, the Pierides sisters into these magpie birds, and that's it. But what was really cool about it was it gave me the chance to use an ensemble of singers, like two female choirs versus each other. So I could have SSAA times two and still have a decent sized ensemble for both of them. In the end, when the victor's crowned, we have this mega massive fugue. And I was like, I know if I'm going to end this festival with this piece, it's got to be a big one. It's got to be a foot stomp and bop. That's got to be catchy. And I need to end this festival with applause. And so I looked back to perhaps the greatest opera ending foot stomping fugue, Falstaff. And then looked as like, what's going on here? Do you say it's just so dense counterpoint, all these voices, like how can I create something that's going to do that? And so in the end I created this big fugue. I believe in the end it's an 8-voice fugue with 8 separate parts, all of them harmonized in the choir. And it's just like builds up tension and goes, and it was cool.
Y'all, it was a bitch to put together.
It was tricky. And of course, you know, there's 4 weeks goes by like that, especially when you're putting on Johnny Skiki, 12 opera scenes, individual coaches. But we came out and we did it. Mm-hmm. And then another cool thing about the piece was there's always a lot of pianists in these festivals. I was like, how do we put them to work? I wrote for my first time piano 4 hands, which was cool. Because, you know, piano 4 hands, like they'd kind of like, I think of like Brahms symphony arrangements for piano 4 hands or 2 pianos. It's like, there's just, you have more access to the whole range of the pianists. You can really make it sound like an orchestra.
Yes.
And so when you have 40 singers going in massive counterpoint, you really need, you know, a piano sound that can give the support. And so the 2 pianists that we had did a fabulous job. And so it was great. It's this 25-minute piece. Now about 20, 21, 22 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. Now, in order to really make it operatic, because Anuccini's libretto is just like scene, 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 but I needed something to give it some type of continuity or unfolding of the narrative. So I said, okay, the guys, I got to put one guy to work in this thing. And then it dawned on me, but Ovid has this whole story told out. Mm. So I looked back into the Metamorphoses in Italian, and then I was like, I can just take the Ovid's little like descriptions, and then the Pierides said this, and then this happened, and this, take like the play by play, turn those into recitatives for the bass baritone who represents Ovid, and then a story starts to evolve, and then you get like, you know, arias, recitatives, chorus numbers, and in this like 20 some minute compact little piece, you have a whole rich world of sound. It was really cool for me to put together in about 5 months. Like, wrote it really, really quick, super inspired. But I had really cool tools because I had this mega big paper that I bought and a staff pen with 5 lines so that I could create like my score in front of me and put it together as I please, like how Stravinsky used to do.
Oh, I would love to see that. Yes.
Oh, so cool. So I'll take a picture. I have pictures of it. I'll send it to you because it's cool just to see staves come and go as the ideas. And so by freeing myself from having to write everything out by hand and then go on the computer, my process like was just like pure creativity, get it all on the page. And then it came together very quickly. And then just to put it together with all the young artists and the programs, you know, for you guys, you come to sing Verdi, you come to sing Mozart, you come to sing Donizetti, whatever. And you're like, well, what are we doing this modern piece for? What is this about? And then to see everybody come together and be like, yeah, we're enjoying this just as much, if not more, than these classic works there. And for the audience, they're like, oh, wait, we're going to hear a contemporary work now? What, we came here for Bellini and beautiful melodies. And I said, oh, you're going to get both. And so for me, it was a real joy to put that together. And you know a thing or two about it because you were Calliope. You sang the number one muse who has, in my opinion, one of the nicest licks that I've written in the past few years. I mean, it's a pretty good tune that you get to sing there.
It was very beautiful. Yes, I was so excited. There's so much to say. Again, it's so interesting that you, when I ask composers about process, because I love talking about and getting to discover like the compositional process and how it kind of differs between musicians, because again, I had so much difficulty in that damn composition class with just like sitting there and looking at Sibelius or whatever and being like, you know, I don't even know how to get started. And so even the process, as you described it, it seems so like simplified in terms of like, I don't know, I just did it and I was inspired and it came together and I wrote it so quickly, so many lines so quickly, plus two, you know, four-handed piano. That's like astounding to me.
That was the trickiest thing, actually, the four-hand piano. I mean, what, I know the language, I love the words. I was super excited about the story, so the inspiration kept flowing. I mean, there were definitely some tricky things, like how do I work out all of this counterpoint, how do I make the lines interesting and meshing and stuff. But the four-hand piano of like trying to put myself in both the primo and the secondo at the same time and try to like make sure things like didn't overlap or they didn't cross, but that they were still balanced. So that was a completely new beast, because I've written choral music, I've written two operas besides that, you know, tons of vocal music, but the piano forehands was the real curveball for me and the challenge. I think what you were saying about the composing, yeah, composing's tricky. There's a lot of different things happening, but I always like to remind myself that composing comes from componere, to put together. All I have to do is put together musical ideas. Hopefully, they're attractive, they're catchy, they're beautiful, they're communicative, they could even be ugly. They're paired with contrast, they're developed and continued. There's just certain principles that kind of enter the subconscious. And so long as you treat it as a game of, I'm going to put this with that. Does that work? Yeah, that works. Great, I'm going to do more of it. That was enough. Let me switch it up. With software, that's also, I mean, that's a huge hurdle, because unless you're fluent in the software, that is a huge obstacle, because then your flow is cut off. Well, I write everything that I do. I always start, at least 75% of it is written out by hand, because between me and the page, there's nothing coming in between except for my pencil. And I've gotten pretty good at, you know, physical writing over the years. Whereas, you know, I switched. Actually, there's another thing with Canora. Once I had the score written by hand, I had just learned a new notation software. I used Finale since 1995, and I swore by Finale. And as my hairline went back and back, and Finale crashed and crashed, at a certain point, I said, enough of this. Enough of this. I got to really see what's up. I heard really great things about Dorico. I was like, all right, let's check this out. Because I couldn't go to Sibelius, because it was like I was born a Yankees fan. Now I'm going to switch to the Mets. No.
Okay. Let's listeners, you can send your hate emails to Raphael. You can send Albert. Albert is. I like
to
Sibelius.
What? To hate email to you or to me? And so, like I said, I couldn't switch teams to Sibelius. So I thought, let me try Dorigo. And Canora was the first big piece that I had to enter in Dorigo. So the learning curve, especially with the aleatoric stuff and all of the different improvised lines without meter and bar lines, like tricking the software to do that was a big learning curve. But it made me stronger.
I've heard good things about Dorico. So I have several professors that use Dorico. So
yeah. Fabulous, but not a substitute for doing anything by hand. So anybody who wants to compose out there, just put stuff together, but make it easy on yourself. Get a pen and paper. And then you see scores like by Barbarian Stripsity or Sequenza Berry. You see, you don't even need a staff. You can just make little drawings and free open score stuff. Like that's also pretty hot in contemporary music. So don't feel like you need to know theory or you need to know orchestra. You know, discover it as you go. And have fun and play. It's a game. It's a puzzle. And so that's why the inspiration flows, because you get in that flow, you get in that zone, you're like, I'm having fun. Oh,
Yeah, I'd also love to know, is there anything, you know, that you wrote down on the page or kind of heard in your head in terms of how it was going to go that you had to change sometime this summer as we were, like, putting it together?
Sure. Luckily, this summer, I started with a score that was finished and performed. The summer before where we premiered it, sure, there was a lot of, oh, we're not going to get this. This is too challenging because in the end, where I would have a group of nine singers doing nine different things, not being like, you know, harmony, but like doing like really complex counterpoint.
Yes.
And I thought this is going to be really cool. But then all of a sudden it wasn't working because everybody had to be 1,000% sure on their line. And there wasn't that like strength in numbers thing as when you get like SA or SSAA in a type of choral setting. So I had to reduce that already. So there was a lot of changing, making cuts. I hacked the heck out of that piece. We probably cut about 6 minutes of it, six, 7 minutes of it, just because it, you know, I had underestimated how big of a piece it was. And sure, for me, I've been with it for months and months and months, but for students that got the score during the first week, had 2 weeks to learn it on top of all the other things, it was tricky.
Sure.
This summer, or this past summer, at least, I mean, there were still changes. There were still, oh, we're going to cut this. We're going to change this note here.
Right, you sounded.
I think even with you, just hearing it, I mean, you sang it so beautifully. And I was like, ah, I'm going to change this rhythm, this note, because it shows off this beautiful thing that you're doing. And so for me, whenever I have the chance myself of working with singers on a song, I'm all about a song of mine. I'm all about changing it, adapting it to make the singer sound good. Because I know if the singer sounds good, the audience is going to like it. The singer's going to feel good. The audience is going to like it. I'm going to feel, and then everybody kind of, they're all involved, you know, there's this real communication thing, this this communicating together. So, yeah.
Yeah. My last question about this, I'd also love to hear a bit about your relationship to performance in terms of how the final performances went. There was a final composer's concert where the other students in the compositional program at Opera Luca who were writing pieces while they were there got to premiere some stuff. I know that you played piano, you were also conducting, so I'd also love to hear about your experience in that concert and like what your relationship to conducting and performance is like in general.
Sure. You know, as I said before, I grew up playing piano. Was like, that was my first instrument, got into conducting a little bit on the side at Manhattan School of Music as a kid. And then when I went to college, I was like, I'm being a composer. I don't have the chops. I don't have the patience to sit down in the practice room by myself for 8 hours a day. Like you need to do if you're going to be a concert pianist.
Oh.
I didn't know anything about collaborative stuff yet at that point. I just knew you're either a concert pianist with a tuxedo or you're a hungry composer in the corner with a black t-shirt, and I look better in black t-shirts. So I was like, I'm going to do that. But still somehow, since I had acquired those musicianship skills of improvising, transposing, lead sheets and stuff, reading from the orchestra scores at the piano as a composer and a conductor, you know, I had those skill sets, which made me a pretty good collaborative pianist, plus the knowledge of the language, you know, having studied French in high school, living with Italian, and just being, having fun with the singers, because the singers were always a lot of fun to party with. So I was around them, I could sight read. And so, you know, I kind of fell into this collaborative keyboardist world, accompanied a lot of voice lessons in college for some extra money on the side. And we had people were like, oh yeah, Rafa can sight read, let's go to him. Rafa can transpose score. And so I had these skill sets that just kept getting put to use. And so I kind of was able to, not by design, just the career of a collaborative pianist vocal coach found me. And I realized that I was having a lot of fun because I got to bring my love of language, my love of sound of language and phonetics and syntax and grammar, all these different things that work together so that we have word shape, semantic meaning, the fundamental essence of communication, that's all there. And then you get to do this like intermedial thing, you get to put that with music. Like that's just so cool. And then the whole thing, like, oh yeah, show the singer, oh, you hear that chord that Mozart just put there? Like you can hear the singer's real pissed, right? They're like, yeah, I hear it. And like that started to inform my composing. And then coaching the singers, I start to get into the, okay, what does the conductor have to do? Because the singer needs to know, is the conductor going to be in four or two? What's he going to do? And so you have to kind of get in the mind of the conductor. So all these different skill sets followed me around. And like I said before at the beginning of the podcast, what I love about Opera Luca for me personally, besides the food, is that chance that I get to put these three aspects together to work, you know, with the and try to show those different perspectives to the people that so that they can, you know, learn from that. Mm-hmm. In the composer's concert was cool because we spent 2 weeks where they developed new songs. They put on old songs that they got to revise and write a new song in Italian or English at the festival. And so just working with each student from 10 o'clock until 1 o'clock every morning, helping them develop their voice, helping them get in contact, get in touch with the text, the sounds they're making, exploring the sounds through music, working with the singers, coaching them as they're working with the singers to develop their ideas and get feedback and kind of like mediating that relationship was super, super exciting. And then to see that come to the culmination at the last day of the festival, once Gianni Schicchi had been performed already twice, once Aria concert in front of the statue of Puccini, in front of the Puccini Museum, you know, this really came to the end with, okay, we've learned about the language, we've learned about performance practice, we've honored the greats, and now look at the music of the future. And look at how beautiful it is, yeah? Because a lot of times, you know, contemporary music has a little stigma around it that, yeah, you know, and very often is it rightfully so. But there are composers out there writing some extremely gorgeous, expressive, communicative music. Doesn't have to be tonal, doesn't have to have pretty melodies, but there are composers that are writing very expressive stuff there. And for me to be able to bring that as a teacher, perform the piano parts for some of the songs, conduct my work, it was just, you know, I was living the dream.
Yes. Yeah. It was wonderful. And yeah, to your point about modern music, I absolutely love performing contemporary music, modernist music. And it's something that as a singer, especially as a soprano with like such a huge amount of repertoire already written for me, I have to seek out opportunities to perform more contemporary music versus just, and also I realize in my, this is interesting because I don't talk about performance a lot on the show because it's like, I'm an academic now, but I still perform. If you have something you want me to sing, you should tell me an email.
And how? Yeah, she sings it. Whoa.
Please do. Yeah, so in terms of my performance life and what I like to perform, I feel like the roles that I've historically gotten, I'm always like the ditzy, like, you know, characters that don't tend to have a lot of depth. And so I feel that performing contemporary music gives me the outlet to explore music that might be a little more challenging, not that the classics aren't challenging, but perhaps challenging in different ways, and also again offer depth of communication and of character that I haven't really experienced in performing these like classics and these greats, right? Because people just won't cast me in you know, more meaty roles. And maybe that will happen once I'm older, right? Like that probably comes also with age and maturity. So we'll see what happens there. But it's like, I don't always want to play like the ditzy flighty kind of characters. And I feel...
You don't get a PhD in music theory to play ditzy flighty characters.
Yes, listeners.
But I think also there's something, in the, like with the big meaty roles and stuff, like there's a reason why these big meaty roles still survive. I mean, there's fabulous music, there's depth of characters in a lot of roles out there. But isn't there something exciting about helping to define a performance practice?
Yes.
Like if you're gonna sing Contessa, you know, who has some of the best arias in all of music, you are fighting against hundreds of thousands of historically best Contessas of all time.
Right. Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of people that know exactly what Mozart wanted and this is right and everything else is wrong. And you have to kind of fit in, but still be personal and expressive, but not do anything that's too crazy to offend it.
Yes.
There's a lot of baggage that comes with traditional opera.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, as a coach, I love kind of sorting through that baggage and helping people make sense of it all. But when you're dealing with a world premiere, something that nobody has any prejudices about, like has no idea what is this going to be like, what is this supposed to be like, doesn't exist. It's just like, what is that?
Yeah.
And so to be able to create something new, modern, and help define, yeah, this is how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
To provide that human source of giving the composer's work a voice, literally in your case, I think that's such a thrilling honor and responsibility you have to, mm-hmm. to, like I said, help define the performance practice of the future.
I would agree. It is really exciting. And I feel like all of my musical experiences to this point have been centered around shedding some of that baggage that I feel, like the burden that I felt in my master's of like, I can only do this one thing and I can only be a singer and I can't have any, again, depth to my musicianship, and being able to shed that. And then it's like, okay, now I'm getting all these roles that I don't, that are fun and that I like to do. But again, kind of one track, I only get to the opportunity to do kind of play kind of one kind of character or sing from one perspective. And I really love being able to step into other perspectives. So yeah, I just appreciated so much. It was definitely, again, I'll say it again, it was the music that I was the most excited to sing, not because the other music wasn't exciting, but because it was something different that I don't get the opportunity to do during the school year, or didn't get the opportunity to do, you know, during my master's and stuff. So yeah, it was just great. It was so fun. And I'm glad to hear that you had fun as well. So let's finish up with talking about some of your work that you're engaging in now. So we had talked briefly about, so you're doing research as well as you're working on a dissertation project. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. So, as I said, in 2017, I moved to Germany. 2009, since 2018, end of 2018, I've been in the University of Graz, as a senior artist working in the opera department as a vocal coach. During the pandemic, it was clear that, everybody had a lot more time on their hands. And, since I had finished my master's so young at 21, I said, you know, maybe a doctorate wouldn't be a bad thing to do. And so it turns out that here in Graz has one of the leading artistic research programs. The degree is called the Doc Artium. And it's one of the leading artistic research programs in Europe. Right, the school is just right down the street from my apartment. And so I applied, I got in, and I'm so excited to be now in the final year of my, I'm on the kind of an accelerated track, really working my butt off to do it. And taking time off from my my job. Mm. So actually, I'm now on what they call here in Austria, Bildungskarenz, which means that instead of going to work for the university, I am getting funded by the Austrian government to do my research, to carry out my doctorate, and to write my dissertation. So I have focused my artistic research, which is cool because it's kind of, like a DMA already has an academic and a performance component to it. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it's similar to that, but the Doc Artium has the same equivalent of a PhD academic rigor methodology.
Ooh.
And a big, so I mean, it's a big doctorate that I didn't really understand. I just thought, I thought I was going into a DMA program.
Yeah, wow.
All right, cool. Couple years, write 80 pages, get out of here, and then call, and then everybody calls me Dr. Fuzu. But I was fortunately, I was very, very wrong. And I've learned more in the past 3 years, I think, than I have in, you know, throughout my whole entire career. No, that's hard to say. But it's just been so fascinating to follow the topics that I'm passionate about, language, expression, the human voice as a communicative force, and empathy, and follow and delve into psychology, aesthetics, philosophy, history, performance practice, music theory, music analysis. There's so many disparate fields that, again, due to the specialization of academia, are so compartmentalized and isolated. And there are things that play at every note that I write of a song all of these different things are happening. I mean, the act of writing a song is a metaphor in itself, is a carrying over from one medium language into the medium of music. And so when that happens, there's so many complex things that happen, even cognitively, where in the brain, and just to think like the fact that I have any idea where any of these things in the brain are located, like I didn't even know about the different parts of the brain until now. What I'm seeing that there's, where I'm reading research, that there's this overlap between where the language, the domain that processes language and that processes the music. And so in a way, a song becomes one of the, or rather texted music becomes one of the most expressive forces, because we have language giving semantic meaning and music giving emotional meaning. And so the music bestows an emotional value or heightens the emotional value of a text, but the text gives meaning, semantic, tangible meaning to the music. And so you have this crossing of domains, this overlap that just, it gets into you. And so just seeing how the brain works, how music is perceived, all these different things, and especially the question of empathy has made me just so much more conscious of myself as an individual in a society, but more than in a society, in just humanity and how connected we all really are. To put myself in the shoes of somebody else, to understand their perspective and realize that we're going through the same things, we all have the same types of needs, and how I can experience myself through the other person who, in the case of a singer, is experiencing themselves through another person, a character that they're portraying, who is then just putting the words of the poet who said, and you have all these things coming together. And that is a really magical thing. And for me to be able to just grapple with all these different topics is really cool. It's really, really inspiring. And to see the different turns that I've been, that I've taken artistically, the way that I've stepped out of my comfort zone and comparing Canora, Contesa, Contesa, Canora, or lo que sea, whatever it may be, comparing that just 2 years ago with the music that I'm writing now, and the integration of text, lyric, diction, performance practice, vocal age, expressive agencies. I feel like I've gained an understanding of the human voice that I was deeper than ever, that I've ever had before. And I've been working professionally in this field for most of my life. And so just the way that artistic research has shaped the way, or changed the way that I think about music, art, and my role as a person in humanity, it seems like it was worth the extra effort to get into this program. Sorry, I know that was a lot. That was like, blah, blah, blah.
No, I love it. I love it.
I'm super excited about this, because like I started to say at the very beginning before we started recording, I'm finally at that point where I'm, I have this, I bought a second desk over here. You can't see it. But all of my books, I have about 40 books that are piled, that are open to the pages where I can cross-reference them. Zotero, oh my God, that I have like software that can keep track of the 280 scholarly articles that I'm dealing with. And I'm at that point where I can actually connect these dots and like see these mind-blowing things. It's really cool. So I'm very, very excited and scared, but but I think there's got to be, that's the drive, that's the fuel that keeps you going. That mix, whether it's composing or writing the dissertation, it's that mix of excitement and fear. And it's like fight or flight. It's like I'm going to flight from ignorance and go towards fight and give them hell along the way. It's cool. I'm very excited about it.
No, it sounds so exciting. And I'm so glad that it's been a fulfilling experience for you, even though you perhaps weren't fully aware of the type of commitment that would be required or exactly how it would manifest. Again, also, you know, for me, the listeners know, this PhD was a total, it sounds like similar to you, a very much a pandemic response for me. In terms of being in that master's program, about to graduate into a pandemic, and it was like, well, okay, I guess there's a PhD over there. I got in. What? Well, I don't really know what this is. Yeah, I'm like, I don't know what this is, but I'm just gonna do it. And that first semester, again, you should have seen me. I was like, reading, writing. I've never read a book. I don't know what's happening.
They lowered our reading and writing courses. I'm not sad.
He was like, wait, papers? I've never written a paper. So, you know, but I'm so glad to hear that it's been fulfilling for you in, again, exactly what our whole conversation has been centered around, which is a multifaceted way of engaging with music and all these different disciplines that you're talking about, being able to connect these different disciplines, these different ways of interacting with music, these different ways of interacting with other collaborators and with putting yourself in the shoes of other collaborators. Oh, it's just such a wonderful, magical, woo-woo thing that we get to do.
It's a special thing that we have, right? This calling, because music, to be a musician, it finds us, yeah? Mm-hmm. And it comes with a joy, comes with a lot of hard times, a lot of self-doubt, a lot of criticism, a lot of failure, a lot of rejection. But the fact that we can use our skills to make a difference in the lives of people, to make people feel things, to make people see themselves differently, to make people, other people, put themselves in other people's shoes. It's such a beautiful, beautiful calling that we have and a wonderful responsibility.
And that is going to do it for this bonus episode of the podcast. Thank you so much to Rafael Fusco for being on the show. I'm really, really happy and thankful to be connected to him going forward and to be aware of his beautiful music. Again, check the show notes for the links to all of his work. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to share your thoughts or feedback with me, if you have questions or comments about any other episode of the show, if you have suggestions for what I should talk about on the show, some music I should be listening to, or something I should be reading, or if you're thinking to yourself, you know what, this is my year. 2024 is my year to get on Her Music Academia. I agree, it is your year. Send me an email at hermusicacademia@gmail.com or go to my website, hermusicacademia.com. If you want to listen to more of me singing, hermusicacademia.com. There's a contact form on the website. Fill it out and get in touch with me. We'll see you back here real soon when we kick off our next season for Black History Month. Until next time, thanks for listening.